We come to the third presentation of the Final Four. And as 2012 has gone through its concourse, the title of the series has morphed and changed, not to be something different, but to show in emphasis a different facet. And there have been five facets. The first was a four-presentation series, which was a prelude to the whole year. And the year's title was Hermetic Bodhisattva Chivalry, in honor of a triad, which is archetypal, a triad of major themes that appeared concomitantly together as a major emphasis of a carrier wave of civilization, and that emphasis surfaced about 90 AD. We're going to mention today, in this fifth emphasis, the first was the prelude, the second was the hermetic bodhisattva chivalry, then we went to just hermetic bodhisattvas, and then to chivalry, bodhisattva, hermetic, and now we're at Hermes quintessential. And we're trying to appreciate an enormous realization cascade about civilization. That though there was a proto-civilization that involved the rise of villages to towns to finally little cities to larger cities, and eventually would come into the shape of leagues of city-states. But the true beginnings of civilization are not about cities, but about language. And the watershed as a referential anchor is the first appearance of written language that was discursive. There had been glyphs, like petroglyphs. There had been signs, different inscriptions. But the first written language that was capable of being discursive was about 4350 BC, as we've been talking about, and apparently appeared in several places at the same time. In pre-dynastic Egypt, the Natufian period, when the populations of northern Africa were squeezed by the increased desiccation of what had been grasslands into the Sahara Desert, they crowded into the Mediterranean coasts, but a lot of them crowded into the Nile River Valley because it was fertile. And so its emphasis was not on cities so much, but on farming district blocks. In Egyptian archaeology, they're called nomes, N-O-M-E-S, nomes. Also in early Sumer, a discursive beginnings of language that became cuneiform. The Egyptian written language became hieroglyphs. And it's interesting because the hieroglyphs came before there was a cursive, demotic form of written glyphs. So that the Egyptian language started off as a very high wisdom language of being written, And the Sumerian was lagging behind a little bit because the cuneiform was adapted from a lot of business, crisscrossing trade routes and so forth, and in Central Asia, and what today is Uzbekistan. The central area at that time was around where Samarkand still is, on the Amu Darya river concourse that was huge and went into what is the tip of northern Afghanistan, pointing into the Hindu Kush, over which there was a series of a couple of passes, and one could drop down into what is today China, the Gobi Desert. In those areas, the written language performed something that was very difficult to understand for a long time. And what it is that when you read a written language, your immediate learning of it has a ritual referent. See Dick run. See Jane pet the dog. And that ritual referent cinches a sense of identification with language, and that somebody who is able to puzzle out what the reference are gets these primitive pictures of what it is, and that their sense then of themselves, because they're successful at identification, is to begin to have a sense of identity. But it changes as you progress in reading. You begin to have a fluid picture, moving pictures. And that fluid picture is not immediately transferable to a written language, but begins to show up as a special capacity in hearing. So that little grade school children everywhere in the world, when they get into what we would call the first grade, love to be read to. Because as they hear language, their imagination becomes creative, and that creative imagination begins to give them the moving pictures, the mental pictures. And it's not so much that they then have a sense of identity as that they have a sense of play. And when it is transferred back to being able to make the pictures move as you read, now instead of cinching identification, it cinches the play, the creative play. And so language becomes visionary rather than ritual. Rather than having its referent back, it has its referent to the ongoing what you're reading. So the ancient wisdom was always, if you can read, you can learn. But if you can write, you can teach. There is a definite sense when one looks at the time scale that it took about 350 years for that series of transitions to occur, so that around 4000 BC, there were enough men and women as a seed population that they had come to relinquish their identification with the ritual nature of life and to shift their allegiance to the possibilities, not just of play now, but of creative new things, other things. And in Genesis, one sees that Adam and Eve are no longer able to stay in Eden because they're not limited to the natural cycle of referentiality. They know symbolically that they are naked, that they must cover themselves. And so they are not punished so much and exiled as they are given the freedom to go and explore, to leave. So that between 4000 BC, which is like the carrier wave from the reference wave of written language, now the visionary carrier wave comes into play. And over the next millennium, the improvement of that carrier wave, of being able to read and having special people like scribes or priests, no difference between them initially. So that by 3000 BC, it's apparent that civilization now has acquired a very large reach. All 28 nomes of Egypt, which had been polarized into north and south groups, are now one dynasty, 3000 BC. In China, you have Fuxi and Nugua, who make the origins of the I Ching in the trigrams, 3000 BC. You have the very powerful Sumerian league of states, so that you have somebody who is really a very powerful king over that whole region. And in Central Asia too, you begin to have the facility for very long caravan trade routes, because the shift goes from just being dependent on camels to being able to have tamed horses. And so the Central Asian taming of the horse allowed them to take what in Western America was called a ramuda, a group of horses with the camel caravan, until you got to where the camels are not very good in the Hindu Kush. They're not very good in those high passes. They're good in the desert. But then you would shift from the camels to the horses. And they found that camels do not do well trying to push or pull carts, but horses can be trained to pull carts. And so you have the beginnings then, not only of carts to carry, but you have the beginnings, finally, of chariots. That you can have a team of horses, or you can have a team of teams of horses with four horses, which is very difficult to handle and maneuver. But if you can, a four-horse chariot is really very powerful. It's powerful as a penetration in warfare, whereas a two-horse chariot is very agile and adds an element where you can begin to have, instead of the clash of lines of armed men, your sense of strategy is to sweep the flanks. The great master of that was Alexander the Great. At the Battle of Issus, he had 10,000 troops, and he had about 2,000 cavalry. And he was facing Darius, who had 1,000,000 men, whose line stretched over hills as far as anyone could imagine. But Alexander moved all of his infantry and cavalry off to one flank and then swung his cavalry directly at the end of the line of the Persians, And they had no ability to maneuver this immense long line. And so the Greeks, led by the cavalry, just chewed up the line like some kind of a game, computer game, and threw them into disarray, and the infantry, which had learned to lock their shields together so that no amount of arrows coming in could penetrate them, and with the short swords, they could literally just dispatch all of the confused Persians, and the Persians lost that battle. And they were so demoralized, and Alexander so energized, and his men so energized, that for the next 11 years, they never lost a battle anywhere, all the way to the Ganges. The Central Asian making of a huge improvement of language in 2000 BC led to an alphabetical language called Avestan in ancient times, about the same time that the Phoenicians on the Mediterranean coast were also making an alphabetization of language. And that 2000 BC carrier wave of having an alphabetized language allowed one to have a common denominator, international language, over as far as you could reach. Because you didn't have to be masterful about reading and writing dozens of different languages, which became impossible. You had a ratioing common denominator, the written language. So that again, language styles civilization. And 2,000 years ago, the carrier wave, as we've been talking about, was that one could learn to read several different levels at the same time from a written language. So that you had the development of allegory, a very complex allegories, not just reading between the lines, but reading over the lines. Visioning became very complex. And that complexity led to the development of what we have seen over the last 2,000 years to our carrier wave, where language has been almost perfected, brought to the ability to have a mathematization to the point of digital, so that one could have a planetary language. That is carryable off planet. So that the entire star system now is going to be a home, as a home. And the ability to see that the digitized zero and one binary bit now can be paired again so that by having a pair of bits as a qubit, one has the ability to keep track of a symmetry of what it is that you're dealing with, at the same time what was previously impossible to deal with, was invisible to deal with, now is capable of being expressed in qubits as a new visionary capacity. And that is that the entanglement of supersymmetry is available for language for the species to go into a completely new carrier wave, a new aeon, as it were. There is an interesting article on a website called The Next Big Future. And this article was published December 19th, 2012, about magnomics, is an extension of spintronics and relate to helix magnetism. And the illustration of it I passed out so that you can see that what happens with magnonics is that the electron capacity, not just to be negative and positive by charge, but also by spin, one way or the other. Hence, from electronics, one can now deal with spintronics. But there's a new quality coming up, and that is if you keep the electrons magnetically aligned close to zero temperature, they do not come out like electrons usually come out, but they come out in terms of the angular momentum of their chirality. And this produces vortices. And this is a photograph of the vortices of electrons coming out in magnonics, which is an extraordinary realization that literally the voice that comes out of this is the voice from the whirlwind in ancient wisdom traditions and relates to an increased spiritual capacity of the human species. So instead of just being Homo sapiens sapiens, man wise about being wise, Homo sapiens stellaris is man wise about star scale wisdom. And in doing so, in doing that, in coming to recognize that, what opens up visionarily is not just the creative imagination now operating, but also, because we have come quite a long ways in civilization, is the remembrance, if we scale ourselves like we've been doing in 2012, that it's not the memory, which is a structure, it's a mental structure in the brain, literally. But remembering is a visionary quality. And remembering braids with creative imagining, and that's where art comes from. And art is able to be prismatic in a way that whatever language structure that you're using, you can now jump it in capacity, so that it's not just visionary, but is able to carry itself through the prismatic men and women who use it prismatically into history. So that vision and history, for the first time, instead of just being related by genius men and women, becomes something that is capable of being taught to almost everyone within a very reasonable short period of time, about the time it takes to get through grade school. This capacity has its harmonic in terms of something that goes beyond the universe. On one scalar, that very cold 0 degrees, that zero field of nature, absorbs the errant confusion back into not itself, because it isn't an it. It doesn't have an itself. A zero field, not a zero point, that's a mental conception. But a zero field absorbs not just the numeration and not just the space dimensions, but absorbs the dimension of time itself, which is what energy really is time. The oomph of energy is time, a dimension. When you look at a 10th grade geometry textbook. They used to have them because they used to be very traditional. It was the same textbook that Euclid wrote 2,300 years ago. And the very first lines translated out of the Greek, a point is a locus of no dimension. When it moves, its motion describes a line. And that line can be then arbitrarily visioned and seen to have a limitation, this line from this point to this point, with the caveat that those points are locuses without dimension. So literally, any line in the universe is illusory, ultimately, because its describing identity is provisional fantasy. But also those lines can intersect, and pretty soon in geometry, one begins to see that the classic intersection is a perpendicular line with a horizontal line, and that if you take provisionally, illusorily, 1/4 of that, now you have a graph. Now you have a graph which will have a time element calibration and a spatial element calibration, and you can graph the movement of things in their motion, and you begin then to have equations. E equals mc squared. But E doesn't equal mc squared in a zero field. Nor does E equal mc squared in an infinite field. Because as the zero field absorbs, eventually gets down to where one has the whirlwind of getting very close to the real, out of which the voice of the divine voice comes. Job finally is able to hear the voice from the whirlwind. And he says appropriately, before I had seen you with my eye, now I behold you as you are. As the zero field absorbs, the infinite field evaporates. Evaporates all of the partiality into all possible worlds. Into a sense where the history now, in its harmonic with vision, becomes kaleidoscopic. Just as the visioning is a differential consciousness, history becomes a kaleidoscopic consciousness. So that the prismatic persons who are able to choreograph this, choreograph it as art, as architecture, as music, as living higher dimensional history, they come to recognize that the referentiality of identity was limited and provisional and also apparent illusion. But the affinity going forward into an infinite field opens up every possibility, not only of creative imagining, one can imagine worlds without end. Also, one has a remembrance that you have facets that have always occurred, or some that have frequently occurred, and you begin to recognize and realize that you belong wherever it is that your sense of creative imagining and remembering takes your zero and infinite possibilities and gives them into a complementarity. And that complementarity, when it is not gone through a reducing identity, when it is freed from the addiction to identification, becomes the word that we use in English, holy. And that holy has a spirit that comes in as a guiding friend of wisdom and brings a third, not a third thing, but brings a third, like a trinity or like a thrice greatest, begins to have the forming of a new geometry. The first stable form in Euclidean geometry is the triangle. The first infinite form in higher dimensions is that the Holy Spirit coming into a complementarity wherever two or more are gathered together in my name, I will be there. Is quite real. We're going to take a break, but I want to give you a translation of something written about 2,000 years ago. This is from Mary Magdalene's Odes of Solomon. This is Ode 30. I've taken the "its" out of the translation so that it reads a little more like the kaleidoscopic differential conscious author actually wrote. Fill yourselves, for yourselves, water from the living fountain of the Lord, because it has been opened for you. And come, all you thirsty, and take a drink, and rest beside the fountain of the Lord, because it is pleasing and sparkling, and perpetually refreshes the self, for much sweeter is its water than honey, and the honeycomb of bees is not to be compared. Because flowed from the lips of the Lord, and named from the heart of the Lord, and came boundless and invisible, and until set in the middle, they knew it not. Blessed are they who have drunk and have refreshed themselves thereby. Hallelujah. Let's take a break. Let's come back to this beautiful Ode 30 by Mary Magdalene. And one of the great composers of the 20th century, Alan Hovhaness, set Ode 30 into a cantata form. Hovhaness was half Scottish and half Armenian. And he was a genius at writing music. And then when he began to have a higher, wider, deeper experience of spirit creativity in the Second World War, he burnt almost all of his compositions and started over again. Because he said, I have learned to make music rather than just to write it. And when he passed away at the age of 90, he had over 400 compositions in his oeuvre, and he's the Mozart of the 20th century. He set four other Odes of Solomon to music. So eventually, if you get around to it, on CD, you can find 5 odes of Solomon set to music. The big cantata, Ode 30, is really quite something. For international music, there are music publishers in New York and in London that still keep in stock an amazing amount of sheet music, not only for individual compositions, but for the various ensembles of music. I recently put an order in to get sheet music of the great Hymn of Jesus set to music by Gustav Holst back in the 1930s, and it was still in print in London. It's interesting for us because the quality in the early 21st century is to recognize and then finally visionarily realize that our capacities for remembering have become asymptotically freed. We are able to not only look through enormous quantities of light years, now billions of light years, into what used to be the past, but is now, just now, currently a part of the emerging future. And what happens here is that the arbiter of identification, the center of one's identity, is habitually the now, the present moment, which is a fiction. The continuity is more characteristic. And it takes attentiveness to at first ignore the distractions of identity. One of the most difficult things is the continuity in meditation, where the meditator no longer occurs. And it shows up in one's sense of language that instead of speaking in phrases and sentences, the biblical phrase is speaking in tongues, that language becomes a cascade that has no present moment, but has presence. And the presence extends in a distributed curiosity way through the continuum. And one of the first really powerful mathematicians to understand that was named Hermann Weyl, W-E-Y-L, one of the great German mathematicians. He left Germany in the 1930s, and when they set up the Institute for Advanced Studies on the Princeton campus to give a home for Einstein, the second person that was invited there was Hermann Weyl. He did a little book called The Continuum, mathematical genius. But what was interesting was that once he was able to express the mathematical vision of the continuum, he began to have an overview that allowed him to develop what eventually, he wrote a very large book on, which is about group theory, the making of groups, which was a tremendous advance because at the time, in the 1920s, all the rage in mathematics and in logic as well was Bertrand Russell's theory of types in his Principia Mathematica, three big volumes from Cambridge, and they used to cost $1,000 if you could find a used set, and that was like 40, 50 years ago. And the case was made that logic and mathematics were two sides of the same coin, and so the logical theory of types must also then be the limitations of the mind's ability to do math, to do mathematics. Weyl's theory of groups took away the compulsiveness of the theory of types and also destroyed the confidence that one could be logical. And there was a great book by Stanley Cavell, finally humorously appreciating a high Dharma humor, a book that he wrote, Must We Mean What We Say? Logicality is an elusive addiction. The great evidence of that, of course, is the 19th century mathematical genius Lewis Carroll, Alice in Wonderland, and the other aspect of that, Alice Through the Looking Glass. Because the mirror quality is one of the ways in which identification is self-confirming, and one's identity is that that's me in the mirror. Or that my sense of identity is me in my mind. But the mind is in a presence, distributed continuity, and while there are groups that are available theoretically to deal with, one deals with them mathematically as sets as well. And the great pioneer of sets was a mathematician in the 19th century. His name was Georg Cantor. And Cantor's beautiful way of understanding set theory in its original was that there is a notation for nothing. He used a Hebrew letter, he was Jewish, and gave it a zero power. And that with that, one freed the compulsive quality for identification in one's mathematique. And what came out of that was the realization in Germany at the time, the great mathematical university was Göttingen. In our time, Oppenheimer was a star American student studying at Göttingen. And many different qualities began to occur. There was a mathematician named Riemann, R-E-I-M-A-N-N. And Riemann came up with something that eventually showed that there is a different way to look at the dimensions of space. You can have a Riemannian space. And it began to occur to a number of persons who gained this presence of distribution over a continuum that could have, nevertheless, groups and sets but not be limited to typology. And geometry shifted from typology to topology. That one takes a look at the landscape of the kind of space that one is dealing with. And that all of a sudden there were many different kinds of space, Banach space, and a great mathematician named David Hilbert brought a lot of it together into a curriculum so that one could become progressively at one's own space, at one's own speed, in one's own maturation, to the realization that mathematics does not have a limitation at all. And out of that, especially in the American Göttingen, which was Princeton, came to be a grand series of volumes from Princeton on new vistas, new visions in mathematics. And I think it's must be over 100 some volumes by now. But I remember a roommate at the University of Wisconsin, Lawrence Balch, who introduced me to recursive functions. And this was like 45 years ago, and he said, there are more books being published every year in mathematics than have ever been published before this year, and that will continue into further years, because there, it's the exploration of an infinite capacity, not only to figure or compute, but also to express. And so a poetic has a mathematic that is related to it. They're minimally cousins. They're very frequently brothers and sisters in a family that has grown incredible. That we see so much confusion today, the end of 2012, the horrendous assault rifle killing of six-year-olds, almost two dozen, and their teachers, and then the killer killing himself after having, in a prelude, shot his mother in the face many times to begin. This kind of madness is an identity that has gone into a skew that it has no chance of coming out of by maintaining an identity, so that the vortex, if you look at it in the way in which it actually generates, by chirality of electron spin, very close to 0 degrees, if it's inverted, it becomes a fearsome dragon of death, fear, loathing. That negative aspect, once it begins, increases its momentum to skew. It's like a golf shot that just finally goes into the parking lot. Or the, by now, almost trite saying of Darth Vader, you don't know the power of the dark side. He didn't either. It doesn't have power. power. And that's why its anger, lust, and greed increase. Because the identification becomes apparently more and more fictional and illusional. And the delusion becomes more and more delusional. That chaos of madness can be absorbed by nature and evaporated by infinite consciousness, such that not only does it not continue, but in a very peculiar, paradoxical way, as if it had never happened at all, as if it were all indeed a bad dream that not only one has wakened from, but there's no memory of that bad dream at all. There's no imaginative fearing. There's no anger that has any referentiality like lust or greed for it to occur. And so it doesn't occur because it never did occur. Homo sapiens stellaris is very special in its infancy, now becoming a child, learning to toddle. It's been over almost 40 years since anyone has walked on the moon, which is incredible to those of us who grew up in the early 40s reading about Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon as if they were just around the corner. The fearsome projection is that some secret power group is capable of hijacking life, and that we have no defense. That somehow there are really very bad aliens, and they can do whatever they want. Their wanting has nothing real about it whatsoever. And they will have to learn from scratch as well. And they will have to pay the fees as well. Next year we're going to look at, for 2013, the way in which there is a seed that became Hermetic America, that opened up the continuity that leads to a star system civilization. One of the great capacities is that the future becomes visionable as the past becomes visionable as well, and that the future and the new past make a, not just a symmetry, but they make a super symmetry where the groups and the sets are able to be not only appreciated in terms of an aesthetic of that balance, become a symmetry, become a pair, become a tunability, become a super symmetry, become a choir of the cosmos. But case in point, yesterday, NASA, using the great capacities of the Kepler, the Hubble, the Spitzer, a number of telescopes and big telescopes, 10-meter telescopes on the Earth, and finally came to understand that an asteroid that will come very close to the Earth in 2040 will miss our planet. It would have ended life completely. It's interesting because when one looks back at the previous aeon, the jubilee of its beginning was 41 AD. And in 41 AD, like 50 years later in 90 AD, one has almost a tsunami of capacity that suddenly emerges. In 41 AD, St. James, who had been given the task to become a tutor for young John Mark, who became St. Mark, because he was only 10 at the crucifixion, resurrection, and he had to be looked after for 3 years up until his bar mitzvah. And it was St. James who was put in charge, not only of the Jerusalem community, but of being the tutor and guide for the youngster who became St. Mark. And in 41 AD, after his bar mitzvah, St. James went on his apostolic mission, which was to far Spain, not just southern Spain on the Mediterranean, but to one of the farthest reaches of Spain in the northern western area. And he was there for 3 years and was so beloved that after he returned back to Jerusalem and was seized by Herod Antipas and beheaded, the remains of St. James were sent back to Spain. And that city there commemorated him. In Spanish, James is Iago, St. James is Iago, Santiago de Compostela, St. James of the Star Field. And the pilgrimage is only second to the pilgrimage to Bethlehem and Jerusalem at Christmas time in the world. This year, more than 250,000 men and women have taken the pilgrimage because it begins in southern France, over the Pyrenees, along through the Basque country to San Iago de Compostela, and you are welcomed there by a community that since the 40s AD has held that the presence of James is still there. It has its manifestation in the great church, in the city, but the manifestation is the continuity of the pilgrimage. He is with those pilgrims on that pilgrimage, and this is why they're able to do that strenuous pilgrimage by the hundreds of thousands every year. Because the St. James of the Star Field is what is called real. More next week.